We learned about his dysfunctional family and, I think it's fair to say it, bizarre upbringing in the runaway hit Running with Scissors. Augustine Burroughs followed that up with memoirs about getting sober and also navigating the rough waters of his relationship with his father. Now in his latest book, Lust and Wonder, he tackles love in all its strange and inexplicable incarnations and opens up about embracing cooking. Welcome to the show, Augustine.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
And congratulations on the book. It's fantastic. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Now, for those people who have not yet read it, like I have, can you just briefly sum it up for us?
Sure. It's Lust and Wonder, and it's a memoir. It's really a love story, is how I think of it. Mm. It's a love story, but you've got to, you know, crawl through some broken glass for a little bit first
before you get to
the love. Yeah. And it's also about the period of my life where I've been sober. I've been sober since 1999. So this is sort of a follow-up, if you will, to my previous memoir, Dry, about my experience with being an alcoholic, working in advertising. So this is what my life has been like without struggling with addiction and how I made kind of more of a mess of my life than I ever did before. So,
and you talk about this as the third installment of your trilogy of memoirs, with Running with Scissors, Dry, and now Lust and Wonder. And I'm curious, how do you see some of the themes that you began years ago work themselves through the different memoirs? How are they the same and how are they different?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I didn't really think of it as a trilogy until after the fact, but mm-hmm. clearly to me it is. And you know, my first memoir was Running with Scissors, about growing up with my mentally ill mother and alcoholic father's lunatic psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. In his house with a bunch of family members and long-term psychiatric patients. And that was a world where there were no rules, there was no structure. You know, there was a lot of sort of abuse going on in that crazy world. And I think that mm-hmm. experience, it honed my sense of humor for sure, because it was so awful that, you know, you've either got to find the humor in it or just check out.
Exactly.
But it also gave me, you know, there was no stability. So finding security and stability and predictability was something that, you know, was very important to me in much of Lust and Wonder, you know, and I made a lot of, you know, really dubious choices because of that search for stability and a guarantee. But, you know, there really are no guarantees in life. And, you know, one of the things I think that's featured in the book a lot as well is I started to doubt my own instinct, my gut instinct, and mm-hmm. that really was, there was a heavy penalty for that.
And I thought, what was really wonderful about the book is it's much more contemplative and thoughtful, I think, than some of the other books. And it was there was a collective breath all readers have had when they got to that point and they realized, oh, he's going to be okay. He's going to make it through all of this and he's going to be okay. And I think your insights on relationships, especially long-term relationships, I thought were very keen and very spot on.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I mean, I was thinking a lot about, you know, compromise. I was in a relationship for almost 10 years with mm-hmm. Someone named Dennis. And, you know, I don't think either of us were fully content and happy. But I kept telling myself, well, this is, you know, relationship experts and, you know, television mm-hmm. and magazines all say, you know, compromise is part of a relationship. But how much compromise? You know, so that's something I was thinking about a lot. And how much compromise was I willing to tolerate? And how much compromise, you know, ought a person to tolerate? When is it too much?
Speaking of Dennis, there is a hilarious section about Thanksgiving at his house. And you say in the book that cooking is his way of showing his love to you.
Right.
But you also say that he used it as a weapon. He withheld food. He didn't cook for you. And he used it as a controlling point. Can you talk a little bit about that dynamic of food in your relationship with Dennis?
Well, you know, there was it really is like you just explained so beautifully. There, he was a very ambitious cook, you know, and he loved to experiment and make very complicated meals. But when things were not going well between us, you know, he would always sort of make something that he knew I was not going to like, you know, maybe from my list of foods that I won't eat or don't like, you know. Or he would not make anything, and it would just be, you know, a very sort of sterile evening. And it was, I think, because we had major communication problems. He had a really difficult time talking to me about what he was feeling and expressing any anger at all. He did not like any sort of conflict, and he didn't like to express you know, discomfort or displeasure. So he would act out, you know, I think in other ways. And certainly, you know, the preparation of food was one of those many ways.
And speaking about holidays and Thanksgiving and being at the table, I'm sure you must have quite a collection of memories of things that happen around the dinner table on holidays. Any of that pop up?
Mm-hmm. You know, in my early childhood, when it was just, you know, living with my parents in Western mm-hmm. Massachusetts, holidays were sort of a somber affair. I mean, they were performed ritualistically, and the foods that were prepared, my parents were both Southern. So, mm-hmm. you know, there was an element of, you know, things were ported from cans, you know, right. mixed together, and hams were from a can, and they were, you know, scored with a knife, and then cloves were inserted. Mm-hmm. But there were not, these were joyless occasions, you know, they were just sort of ritualistically performed. And then when I was growing up in the psychiatrist's house with his family, holidays were a lot more fun, but they were also a lot crazier, you know, and so many, many people dropped by. It was like a train station, and it was messy mm-hmm. and disorganized and crazy, but it was, you know, there was a lot more sort of love, I think, there. And my holidays over the past few years have been really, really great and unusual too, you know, and mm-hmm. I have cooked more than I ever did.
Do you enjoy cooking?
Which, you know, I do, you know, I really do. And one thing I have really been enjoying lately, of all things, is making pine needle and rosemary bread, because we have a lot of pine needles, white pine, on the right. property. And so pine needle and rosemary bread is a thing that goes together really well.
And have you found that your embracing of cooking goes along with your journey of sort of becoming more settled with yourself?
Absolutely. I'm not, you know, in sort of crisis mode at all times. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is really, cooking is similar to reading for me. I didn't read a book until I was 24. And it's not because I couldn't mm-hmm. read. It's because to read, you need peace and silence and space physically right. and, you know, sort of psychologically. And it's the same with cooking. I mean, much of my life has been about triage, you know, and putting out sort of these emotional and psychological yeah. fires.
Right.
But, you know, it's not like that now. It really isn't. I'm in a much better, happier place, so there's time to let bread rise.
Would you please read that section about Thanksgiving at Dennis's house?
I'd love to. Dennis was hosting the holiday meal at his L-shaped studio on West 72nd. The apartment had been improved since me, the boxes had been unpacked, and had contained mostly expired pens and stationery from an ancient job, and after several trips to Pottery Barn, it was slightly less pitiful. I was excited. Normal, stable people celebrated holidays. We went shopping at Fairway, and Dennis had already laid out several cookbooks on the kitchen counter. I'd assumed cooking would mean throwing a turkey into the oven and opening a few cans of cranberry sauce while we lay in bed and watched pay-per-view until the guests arrived. But this was not the plan. The plan was for Dennis to create several painfully elaborate and complex dishes from Cooks Illustrated, using each skillet, pot, utensil, and pan at least once. My job was to remain fixed in place at the shallow stainless steel sink in his narrow galley kitchen with a scouring pad to wash and dry in a never-ending one-man assembly line. By the time the guests arrived, my hands were red, swollen, and steaming, but I felt I'd participated in preparing the meal. It was our Thanksgiving, even though the table was populated with an increasingly strange group of strangers. Dennis did a heroic job of keeping the conversation as light and as jovial as possible, though it had seemed to be an inordinate amount of preparation. Each measurement involved him sliding a knife over the top of a half teaspoon or a quarter cup so it was perfectly exactly level, not a crumb more or less. The meal really was delicious. "The food is spectacular, Dennis," I said, and this pleased him. "I think the stuffing is a little dry," he said. "I should have used more liquid from the mushrooms." There arrived a period of silence when people were concentrating on chewing, and it was during this moment that Dennis suddenly let out a high-pitched scream and covered his mouth. "Oh my God! Oh my God!" he cried through his cupped fingers. I tensed. Was he choking on a wishbone? Did he bite down on his tongue? Then a terrible thought. Was there part of a rat in the creamed spinach? He shoved back from the table, shrieking, my cap came off, oh my God. There, through the gaps between his fingers, I could see a drilled down stump right in the front of his mouth. I glanced down at his plate, and there lay one of the perfect white teeth I'd so admired, stuck into a braised baby carrot flecked with fresh mint. Others noticed it too, and there was stifled but audible laughter. When he pulled his hands away, he forgot to close his mouth, so he looked like a hillbilly. I saw tears spring up in his eyes as he grabbed the carrot with its embedded tooth and rushed into the bathroom. I felt terrible for him and considered rushing back after him, but something told me he wouldn't appreciate it. With Dennis now gone, nobody said a word, and I didn't even attempt to make conversation, even though, as the new boyfriend of the host, part of my co-host job description was making conversation. When Dennis returned several minutes later, he was smiling like nothing happened, his tooth restored to its central position. He took his seat. Sorry for the drama and excitement, he said, grinning. It was this new crown. I was able to cram it back into place, but I definitely have to see a dentist. Paula, whose cold bitterness rendered her less interesting than underbed dust, remarked, I had a silver filling fall into a bowl of cream of wheat once. I thought, but did not say, of course you did.
Augustine, it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Augustine Burroughs is the author of 6 New York Times bestselling memoirs. His latest is Lust and Wonder. And if you head to the website, you can listen to my extended conversation with Augustine and hear him read a hilarious Thanksgiving scene from the book. You know where to go, splendidtable.org. And I hope you'll join me when I host again for my next book chat, when I talk to Diane Abu-Jabbar, author of Life Without a Recipe. So pick up your copy and read along with me.